Eco Report is a weekly public affairs program
providing independent media coverage
of environmental and ecological studies
with a focus on local, state, and regional people, issues, and events
in order to foster open discussion
of human relationships with nature and the earth
and to encourage you to take personal responsibility for living sustainably in the world.
Eco Report is produced by an independent team of volunteers
working at the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
And financially supported by listeners like you.
Good morning and welcome to Eco Report. For WFHB, I'm Dan Young.
And I'm Kelly Miller with news the Earth wants you to hear.
Interstate 69 construction is still damaging waterways in Monroe County more than 15 months after the issue first came to light. That's according to members of the Bloomington-Monroe County Metropolitan Planning Organization's Policy Committee. At a meeting last week, committee member Scott Wells showed photos of brown tap water and streams contaminated with sediment. Wells said local officials need to keep pressure on the State Department of Transportation, or NDOT.
I think part of the reason, from what I've heard from people, is we've just pulled a discussion because we're concerned that, you know, since the leverage of getting money comes from the people above us, NDOT et al., and some other people, that if we keep talking about it, you know, some of our funding might be pulled. So it's kind of just vanished.
Wells said a family in the southeastern part of the county recently lost their drinking water. He presented pictures showing sediment-filled water coming out of their faucets.
This is their tap water now. This is August 22nd of this year. Imagine you come home from a hard day and you're ready to have some dinner or something and you turn on your water faucet. That's not drinkable. That's unacceptable. The erosion control. Next picture. There it is. There's your drinking water. This is the second situation now out there. To sit here and not talk about it. Yeah, politician, yeah, we better not talk about it because we want to make sure we get our money or whatever. I'm talking about it because these are friends of mine. This is the county council district where I live in, and I think it's important. It's not whether you're a politician, whether you're Democrat or Republican. It's about we got to fix these problems.
Contractors working on I-69 have been cited numerous times for failing to control erosion. Local officials have complained to state and federal regulators. But committee member Andy Ruff said NDOT hasn't followed up on promises to deal with the issue.
What people in general need to understand is that Indian Creek, which is a state-designated high-value stream of national significance and international significance, actually is a karst stream. It's been written in scientific geological papers as an example of a stream that has sinks and springs and swallow holes. The stream has been sacrificed in the name of this project.
The Metropolitan Planning Organization's Policy Committee has repeatedly asked NDOT to respond to specific concerns about contamination. But the state has never held a public meeting on the issue. Tony McClellan, a deputy commissioner with NDOT, said the agency won't talk with the committee about the problem because it's occurring outside of the Metropolitan Planning Organization's jurisdiction.
I and the department cannot control what's discussed on this particular policy committee. I wouldn't want to dream of trying to do that, but what I can tell you is that the Department of Transportation will not respond, especially to these kind of complaints in this meeting when they're in regards to Section 4. If they're within the policy's jurisdiction, we can discuss that and we'll look at ways to address. But even then, this is not the proper form for this.
Although the current contamination is beyond the planning organization's jurisdiction, committee members worry similar problems might persist as construction moves into Bloomington. Committee member Cheryl Munson said she hopes NDOT is sincere in its promises to handle complaints through other channels.
Since Mr. McClellan said the project manager and the customer service representatives for NDOT Section 4 and Section 5 are the people to contact in the interest of serving the public of Monroe County, I hope their phone numbers, names, phone numbers, and emails will be publicized. And you may not be prepared to give those to us now, but I would like you to give them to the MPO office, and I would like to know them, actually. and I hope they would be available to the Herald Times so that the public knows who are the right people to call when they have a problem.
McClellan did not immediately issue a public response to Munson's request.
Climate change could threaten half of North American birds by the end of the century. That's according to a new study from the National Audubon Society. Gary Langham, Audubon's chief scientist, says half of the birds of North America are at risk of extinction. 314 out of 588 bird species studied could lose most of the area they currently occupy because of a warming planet. Nearly 200 of these threatened species may find hospitable conditions elsewhere, but for 126 species, there may be nowhere to go. Shifts in climate change could affect the range of grasslands, forests, marshlands, and other bird habitats. Scientists have known for some time that species of all kinds will have to move, and in some cases are already moving to adapt to a warming planet. Purdue Wildlife Ecology Professor Barry Dunning commented that a very large percentage of our common native birds here in Indiana may decline, some to the point of extinction. For example, the study suggests by the year 2080, the bald eagle will have lost 73% of its breeding range because of rising temperatures. Most of these species are not disappearing entirely, but will shift their ranges out of Indiana. Dunning's own studies suggest that over the next couple of decades, 70% of Indiana's native bird population may decline because of climate change.
The UN Climate Summit will take place next week in New York City. But before that, the city will host this Sunday's People's Climate March. Tens of thousands of people are expected to participate in the event, which organizers hope will be the largest climate march in world history. Over 1,000 organizations have signed up to take part in the march, including nonprofits, labor unions, religious groups, advocacy organizations, and schools. Busloads of people are headed for the march from all over the country, and Bloomington's Unitarian Universalist Church is offering $25 round-trip bus rides to the event, leaving this Saturday and returning next Monday. Organizers of the Climate March believe the world leaders at the UN Climate Summit need to feel pressure from the people if they're to enact substantive, binding rules for staving off catastrophic climate change.
As CO2 emissions into the atmosphere reach historic levels, Indiana's senior politicians are bragging about their efforts to continue this dangerous trend. Last week, the World Meteorological Organization released findings that the level of heat trapping carbon dioxide in the atmosphere rose at a record-shattering pace last year. The scientists from this UN advisory body also expressed surprise at their findings and fear of the acceleration of global warming and climate change. The report went on to note that concentrations of nearly all the major greenhouse gases reached historic highs last year, reflecting ever-rising emissions from automobiles and smokestacks and a diminishing ability of the world's oceans and plant life to soak up the excess carbon put into the atmosphere by humans. Also last week, Indiana Governor Pence released a letter that he signed along with 14 other state governors, addressed to President Obama, asking him to veto new greenhouse gas regulations proposed by the Environmental Protection Agency. These measures would reduce the permitted amount of greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. They are especially focused on coal-burning power plants, which produce more CO2 than any other fuel. In order to comply, most older coal plants would have to undergo major upgrades, switch to cleaner fuels, or shut down. Governor Pence also dispatched Tom Easterly, the commissioner of Indiana's Department of Environmental Management, to tell a House of Representatives Subcommittee on Energy and Power that the new PA regulations would, quote, cause significant harm to Hoosiers without providing any measurable offsetting benefits, end quote. Meanwhile, Indiana's Democratic Senator Joan Donnelly and Republican Senator Dan Coats, along with 50 other senators, published similar letters requesting a 60-day extension of the public comment period on the EPA's proposed rule. This extension would be on top of the current 120-day comment period. Senator Donnelly has come out in the past supporting all types of electricity generation, including coal, if they will help create jobs, keep energy prices down, and move the country to energy self-sufficiency. Senator Coats complained that the proposed rules will, quote, restructure our entire electricity sector, kill reliable coal power, and raise energy prices, end quote. Meanwhile, global climate scientists believe the world's oceans have reached their capacity to absorb carbon, which means that levels in the atmosphere will increase at an even faster pace.
A new Green Gadgets report from Greenpeace shows that major consumer electronics companies are using toxic chemicals in their smartphones, TVs, tablets, computers, and cables. Greenpeace found that as many as 50% of smartphones contain toxic chemicals, including polyvinyl chloride and bromated flame retardants. These chemicals are released when the devices are recycled. Bromated flame retardants build up in humans and animals and are most hazardous when disposed of by incineration, smelting, and open burning. Long-term exposure to them is associated with kidney and brain damage. Polyvinyl chloride is a threat to people and the environment from manufacture to disposal. Its manufacturer uses toxic raw materials, including vinyl chloride monomer, which is carcinogenic. Polyvinyl chloride is often disposed of by burning, which emits toxic chlorine and additives.
Southern Indiana has been invaded by masses of fall armyworms in turf grass areas. That's according to Larry Kaplan, Extension Horticulture Educator for the Purdue Extension Service, Vandenberg County. Adult armyworm moths lay their eggs in large masses. When the eggs hatch, the emerging caterpillars begin to feed and move across the infested area. They tend to radiate outward from a central place where the eggs were laid. When the larvae are small, the feeding causes little damage and may go unnoticed. As they continue to grow, though, the caterpillars consume larger amounts of crop or turf. Where heavy infestations occur, a typical home lawn may seem to disappear almost overnight. Armyworm larvae vary in color from dark greenish-brown to black. On each side, there are long, pale white, orange, and dark brown stripes along the length of the abdomen. Mature larvae are approximately 1.5 inches long. The armyworm moth, approximately 1 inch long with 1.5 inch wingspan, is tan to light brown, with a tiny white spot centered on each forewing. It is unknown if there have been any outbreaks in Monroe County, but according to Purdue, the fall armyworms are being seen throughout southern Indiana, and a University of Kentucky expert shared information that shows most of western Kentucky has also been hit.
The planet's ozone layer is beginning to recover from damage done by humans. This is thanks mainly to the 1980s phase-out of chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs. These substances were once used in refrigerators, air conditioners, and aerosol cans. Ozone in the stratosphere protects the planet from solar ultraviolet rays, which cause skin cancer and crop damage, among other problems. According to chemist Mario Molina, who won a Nobel Prize for his studies of the ozone layer, the recovery of the ozone layer is, quote, a victory for diplomacy and for science and for the fact that we are able to work together, end quote. But there is a downside. The ozone recovery has been partly accomplished by replacing CFCs in some devices with substances that make a major contribution to global warming. And, interestingly enough, according to NASA scientist Paul A. Newman, rising levels of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases actually cool the planet's upper stratosphere, and this cooler air increases the amount of ozone, meaning that global warming itself is helping regenerate the planet's ozone layer.
That's a look at Eco News from Bloomington and Beyond for this week. We want to know what you think of current environmental issues. Send your comments and story ideas to earth@wfhb.org. For Eco Report, I'm Kelly Miller.
And I'm Dan Young. Eco Report is brought to you in part by Solar Systems of Indiana, designing and installing renewable energy systems. SSI is a member of the North American Board of Certified Energy Practitioners and works to foster the acceptance of solar energy across the Midwest through education and consultation. More information by phone at 812-336-2785 or online at solarsystemsofindiana.com.
In today's Eco Report feature, the latest on Monroe County's effort to implement a materials recovery facility, or MRF. In a 4-3 vote, the Monroe County Solid Waste Management District Board approved a 2015 budget with funds appropriated for a clean stream materials recovery facility Thursday evening on August 14th. When the district board heard the initial proposal for the facility last month, Operations Director Scott Morgan said it was expected to increase county revenue by $288,800 annually, but the new revenues in the amended budget show an increase of $246,000. That original plan also included investing $250,000 to create the facility, but the new budget estimates $255,000 in capital investments. The proposal outlined in July included opening a 12,500-square-foot facility at the old Monroe County landfill. It's projected to be capable of processing at least 70 tons of recycled material per week through a fiber processing line and plastics processing line. According to district records, 3,220 tons of recyclables of all types were processed in 2012. City Councilmember Volan said approving the amended budget was the last step, and staff can take action to open the facility by the end of the year. The facility would not be dual stream, meaning it would only process clean recyclables like glass, aluminum, and plastics. It would not sort recyclable material out of commingled waste stream.
The idea is that collecting recyclables isn't the end of the line. In order to be able to sell them for what they're worth, which is more than trash, they need to be baled into a rectangular cube the size of a semi-truck or a rail car. And that's how they get sold on the open market. And not only are we not getting what that's where you get the full commodity value of a batch of plastic or aluminum or whatever commodity recycling. Over the years, we haven't necessarily been able to guarantee that all of our recycling is getting recycled, let alone that we as a community are getting the market value for those commodities. And the MRF will allow us to not only get the market value effort for our commodities, but to guarantee that everything that comes to that facility will be recycled.
Okay, and for the last few years that this is being talked about, this concept of doing more to handle the recyclable materials, I think it was originally conceived that there would be a dual stream MRF.
It wasn't original. The original idea 5 years ago now was for the district to build a facility simply big enough to process the recyclables already coming to it. We actually approved that as a board 5 years ago, but the director at the time, Larry Barker, after getting the approval, realized that there would be a greater demand from the community than just what's already coming into the district. And so we started looking at bigger facilities to handle waste from the city of Bloomington, from IU and so on. It was only the beginning of this year that he brought forward the concept of a dual stream MRF that would handle not only the existing recyclables that we get, but that could also handle the entire waste stream, the stuff that's not separated, where it's just that would take in all trash and effectively be a transfer station, but that would take the vast majority of that content out of the waste stream and make it recyclable, organic waste and the like.
A dual stream MRF is a clear stream, which we are doing now. And the second piece is what is called a waste stream. Legislation was passed this year that has the goal for the state of Indiana to pull 50% of the recyclable material out of the waste stream. David, everybody doesn't recycle. We found that in this community, probably 35 to 38% at best is the recycling percentage in this community of Monroe County, of Bloomington. And we're a very progressive community. So what a dual stream MRF does is has the clean stream for everybody who does curbside, everybody who does our blue bins, all of the other small little community actions like Chad Roeder's down behind the city of Bloomington. That's all clear stream. That part of the recyclables has never actually touched the waste stream because the homeowners and the citizens of Monroe County have already pulled them out. The dual stream or the waste stream is those residents or municipalities or community members who decide not to recycle. They just put all of it in a trash container and it's picked up as trash. We call that municipal solid waste. The dual stream is a process by which you dump all of that municipal solid waste and it goes through a conveyor process with tumblers and bag breakers and magnetrons and eddy currents and optical readers and air and vacuum, and it actually pulls and sucks out those recyclables that's in that waste stream. Studies have shown that greater than 60% of the waste stream has recyclable content in it. So our goal, as well as the mission of the district, has always been to reduce the waste stream. And the only way we can effectively reduce the waste stream is through a waste stream material recovery facility process. Pull those recyclables out of the waste stream so they don't go to a landfill for final disposal.
So rather than try to advance a one giant facility that would do both streams, we elected instead to try to build such facility in stages. It would all be at the landfill. Each stage doesn't require the other stage to exist. If we build a waste stream later on top of a clean stream facility, you know, that's fine. It can use the same land and the same buildings and most of the same equipment. So the board wasn't ready to decide on going ahead with a waste stream MRF, but they were ready to decide to accept the clean stream MRF that was approved last month. Hopefully we can have it built by the end of the year. So, and then the waste stream would be a separate challenge to design, approve, and build.
It's anticipated that the cost of operating the facility and the capital investment and such would be offset by the amount of money that the district gets back by selling.
Yes, we anticipate that the existence of the clean stream MRF alone will reduce our expenses by, I think it's about $100,000 a year. So that's a win, you know.
How would it affect the current contract with Hoosier Disposal?
They're not related. We're already separating recycling from municipal solid waste. This is only for recyclables that we are already collecting here at this site and at our four rural sites. Our legal counsel has determined that the contract we have with Hoosier Disposal Republic Services would not in any way be affected by our construction of this facility. If we were to build a waste stream portion of a MRF, a waste stream function, that would materially, that is described in the contract, and that would affect the contract, but we're not there yet.
When do you expect this operation to be up and running?
The capital cost associated with this is around $255,000, I believe. That's already part of the 2015 budget. However, the Solid Waste Board can go in and request that we go ahead with a special appropriation, which is ask for more money that's already in our budget, okay?
The dollars we would spend on January 1st that have already been approved through due process are the same dollars that we would spend now if we spent them 3 months early. We're going to be asking the board to approve those dollars now rather than in January. There's no reason to wait.
So if it's approved, when should it be up and running?
About 120 days after the approval, in other words, after County Council approves the additional appropriation of the dollars into the 2014 budget, about 120 days is also going to take us to have it up and operational.
Okay.
Thank you, David.
It's 11:53 a.m. and you're listening to Eco Report on WFHB, the show the Earth wants you to hear. Would you like to join the Eco Report crew? WFHB is looking for volunteer reporters and engineers to join our award-winning news department. We provide training and will work with all schedules. Just bring your love for the environment. For more information, email volunteer@wfhb.org or call 812-323-1200.
It's time now for In Nature, a new segment on Eco Report focusing on the flora and fauna of South Central Indiana.
Recently, we learned about cicadas. One of the most interesting predators of cicadas is the large wasp, commonly referred to as the cicada killer, whose Latin name is Sphecis speciosus. These wasps can be from 0.6 inches to 2 inches long, and females are usually larger than males. Their thorax is hairy, reddish, and black. Their abdominal or rear segment appears striped, with some stripes yellow and the others either black or reddish-brown. Their wings are brownish, and they have long, delicate antennae. Because they are one of the largest wasp species seen in the U.S., and their coloration superficially resembles that of some yellowjacket and hornet species, many people are initially frightened of cicada killers. However, they are not dangerous. Males cannot sting at all, while females almost never sting humans. Adult cicada killers emerge in June and July and die out again by September or October. During their adult lives, they mainly feed on flower nectar. Males spend the majority of their lives battling each other over females. It is the females who kill cicadas. They dig holes in the ground to lay their eggs, which are 10 to 20 inches deep and a little more than half an inch wide. In this burrow, the female cicada killer also digs a nest chamber. After this, she goes above ground and paralyzes a cicada with her sting. She then brings the cicada down into her nest, despite the fact that the cicadas are often more than twice her weight. If she is going to lay an egg for a male, the mother cicada killer will only bring one cicada into her nest. But if the egg is to be for a female, it will often be left with several cicadas, because the females are larger and will need more food. Once the mother cicada killer has brought one or more cicadas to her nest, she lays a single egg on a cicada. The egg hatches within 2 days and develops for 2 weeks. The larvae overwinter in an earth-coated cocoon, then pupate in the spring, to emerge in summer as the next generation of cicada killers. That wraps up our show for this week. Eco Report is brought to you in part by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
This week's news stories were written by Joe Crawford, Linda Green, Norm Holy, and David Murphy. This week's feature was engineered by Allison Bektesh. Our broadcast engineer is Dan Withard. Producers for Eco Report are Stephanie Stewart, Dan Young, and me, Kelly Miller. Executive producer is Allison Bektesh. For WFHB, I'm Kelly Miller.
And I'm Dan Young. Join us next week on Eco Report, encouraging you to take personal responsibility for the world in which we live.
You've been listening to the Eco Report,
a volunteer-powered production of Community Radio WFHB
in Bloomington, Indiana.
Available for download and podcast at news.wfhb.org.
Eco Report is your independent, ecologically inspired news source
for South Central Indiana,
bringing you news that the Earth wants you to hear.
Send your comments, suggestions, and story ideas
directly to the Eco Report staff.
The email address is
earth@wfhb.org.
That's earth@wfhb.org.